The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Hello, welcome to another Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly, host of the show and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that's there for people with cancer wanting to look outside the box of conventional treatments and do much more to help themselves regain their health. A few years ago, stage 4 cancer patients in the UK were simply expected to stiffen their upper lips and die quietly. But now there's some very vocal stage 4ers who are determined to be heard and determined to tell anyone who'll listen what they're doing to extend and improve their lives through integrative medicine. Jill Smith is in this group of revolutionaries and has published her story in a book called Because You Can. Jill agreed to talk to me for the show over Skype from her home in West Sussex.
Hello, Robin. Good afternoon.
Nice to talk to you. I've just finished reading your book, Because You Can, and there's actually far too much to talk about in there for just one show, but I hope we can cover quite a bit. It starts out with some quotes, the first one of which I really like is by Sartre, and it says, "Freedom is what we do with what's been done to us." Why did you want to start your book with this quote?
Oh, well, there were a number of quotes that I sort of came across at a time when I'd finished chemotherapy and was able to be a bit more reflective. So there was that one from Sartre, there was one by Maya Angelou and Viktor Frankl, who was a Holocaust survivor, but yes. Also he treated cancer as being something more difficult to survive and face up to. I think that mental attitude is so much an important part of how we deal with having cancer. I'm a stage 4 cancer sufferer, so this is my experience, and this is where I talk from. And I think it's quite different for people who have early stage cancer that can be hopefully cut out or cured or whatever. But for those of us who have to live with cancer until we die, and the prognosis is not poor, but if we hope to live for longer than the medical prognosis, and there's lots of dimensions to that, yes. I think mental attitude is the key thing that makes the difference. And therefore the quote, it's not what life throws at you, it's the meaning that you make about it. So the quote was, "What freedom is what we do and with what has been done to us."
Yes, that's right.
We have a choice.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Yeah, okay. So perhaps you just want to fill in a little bit of your background before you had cancer, because obviously that does play into your book and your general attitude.
Yes, indeed. So my early career was in advertising and qualitative research and consultancy, which at a certain stage I made a crossover into coaching, executive coaching, personal coaching, life coaching, whatever. So I was a professional coach. And as part of my training, I learned a great deal about positive psychology, reframing each situation so that instead of putting the worst interpretation on it, you put the best interpretation on it, and so on. Mm-hmm. So I was quite well trained in all of these kind of mental attitudes and thought processes, which has certainly stood me in good stead. So I'd been a coaching at sort of the highest level for about 10 years before I was diagnosed with the cancer.
And out of interest, did you feel it gave you everything you needed essentially to meet the challenge that you had? Because it's a huge challenge, of course. This is as big as they get in many ways.
Does anything ever give you everything? the challenge changes over time. I mean, obviously there's good days and there's bad days, and it would be completely unrealistic to expect everybody to have a positive mental attitude at all times.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's very Pollyanna-ish and completely unrealistic. But it's a sort of a subtle thing. I mean, the title of my book is Because You Can, because it's easy to focus on what you've given up, how you're not the person you used to be, how life's never going to go back to how it was. You can't earn as much, perhaps. You can't do as much, and it's all doom and gloom. So it's very easy to go down that path and feel sorry for yourself. It's much better if instead of focusing on what you can't do, you focus on what you can do. And some of my most positive days were days when I was in hospital, when I was able to do very little. So I could congratulate myself on being able to have a shower or get dressed. Those would be huge, huge victories.
Right.
But they give you a dopamine reward and you feel better for it. And I'm sure that what goes on in your brain has an effect on what happens in the rest of your body. So mental attitude affects physiology.
Yes, definitely. So as far as I can tell, you're pretty ruthlessly objective with regards to yourself. As these things go, were you always like this, or did it come with the cancer?
Oh, no, I've always been very objective. I mean, my life story, I've always felt like a bit of an outsider, because when I was a child, we moved when I was about four, so just before I started school. Mm-hmm. So I had a kind of difficult time at the very beginning of primary school. I felt different to the other children. I had a Scottish accent and not an English accent, and I was a bit bullied. So I kind of put my objectiveness, I suppose, to that period. And throughout my life, I've always been both in my life and slightly outside it as an observer. And that's just the way I am.
Interesting.
Well, served me well in qualitative research and advertising, and then even more so in coaching.
Yeah, well, it serves you well in life, actually, that kind of thing, I think. But it's not so easy to come by for a lot of people. Well, you left your Scots accent back then. Was that an adaptation for circumstances, survival?
Very much so. I didn't leave it. I parked it and kept it for use at home, and very quickly picked up an English accent for use at school. And so when I was sometimes met at school with my mother, I wouldn't speak to her until we were outside of the school grounds and where anybody could hear me. And I was sort of very conflicted and embarrassed about it for quite a long time. So I picked up an English accent, and I can switch between English and Scottish as kind of like being bilingual.
A dual language, yeah.
Yeah, my brother, who was only one when we moved from Scotland, so you would expect him to learn an English accent. He learned a Scottish accent from my parents and has persisted with a Scottish accent ever since, and he's 100% consistent. So no, it was a, it was obviously presumably unconscious, but yeah, I guess at age five, I must have been very determined to survive somehow.
You really needed to do it. Anyway, very good English accent, I can't tell. So right, so look, you say that in your book, you, to quote you, it seems that the hardest thing to deal with in this situation is uncertainty. So I completely agree with you on this. Most people spend their time trying to achieve a level of certainty in their lives to kind of wrap around their inherent vulnerability and to sort of damp down at least some of the fear of life. Cancer, of course, tears all of that away instantly and brutally. It's undoubtedly very hard, but there is, of course, a silver lining to it. What's been your experience of living with uncertainty?
Yeah, well, living with uncertainty is always going to be difficult. And, you know, I always run two scenarios in my mind. I hope and expect to outlive my medical prognosis, which is pretty dire. So I expect to live for a whole lot longer. While at the same time, I have to accept that objectively, all the evidence suggests that I'll have a shorter time to live rather than a longer time. So I'm running these two parallel scenarios in my mind. Living with uncertainty. I mean, I think the worst time is the beginning when you know, first of all, you don't know what kind of cancer you've got, what's the primary, you don't know what treatment's going to be available. And then once you start treatment, you don't know what the side effects are going to be. In my case, they were far worse than I imagined they were ever going to be. You don't know whether what you're going to be capable of in the future. And I think the difficult thing over time is just adjusting to reality and accepting what reality is going to be, which is quite different to how it looks at the beginning. I mean, at the beginning, I assumed that once I got through the first stage and I knew that it was breast cancer that had metastasized and I knew what my treatment was going to be, I assumed that I'd have a few months of chemo, as well as the monoclonal antibody treatment drugs. And when the chemo dropped out, I would get my life back and I would be able to go back to normal again for a period of about 18 months. And then the drugs would run out and stop working and then I'd die. So I was looking forward to, after Christmas, getting my life back, being able to go back to work, being able to do all the things that I'd been able to do before, except possibly not be able to play tennis again. In fact, I never have done or will regain the sort of normality that I had before my diagnosis. But it's taken a while for that reality to become evident and sink in. And, you know, a lot of that's tied up with your sense of self-identity. I mean, cancer doesn't just rob you of your hair, of your chemotherapy, and give you nasty side effects, but your own self-identity, if your brain is addled by chemo brain, or in my case, more recently, radio brain, which I have to say is worse than chemo brain, and you're used to being an awesomely competent person that can achieve everything and multitask, and suddenly you're completely useless and stupid and unreliable, you're not the person that you used to be. And that's very profound. I think it depends. Work is a big thing too. It depends what kind of work you do. I mean, some people are able to return to work, and that must be very welcome if they like their work and they feel physically capable of it. In my case, working was coaching, and in order to be ethical, I would have to be at the top of my game and feel completely reliable. and I couldn't guarantee either of those things. So first of all, I had to give up paid coaching. And then secondly, I had to give up on the idea of a business that I was going to start called, ironically, The Brain at Work. It felt a bit like karma that, you know, the universe was trying to tell me, oh, so you think you're a coach? Well, here you are. Here's some, here's cancer, just to give you a lesson to realise that you haven't been living life properly. You've been focusing on the wrong things. Here you are. Learn this lesson and live life better. And, you know, you'll have realised that you could have coached better, or you could coach better in the future or whatever. Then 1 year on, I developed brain metastases. So you're going to start a business called The Brain at Work, bringing the findings of neuroscience into the workplace and helping organisations be better places to work. Well, here you are. Here's a brain that doesn't work. See what that feels like.
Right.
So, lots of uncertainty there.
Lots of uncertainty.
And different kinds of uncertainty over time. Yes, yeah. Quite difficult to adjust to.
Yeah, well, it is a world of uncertainty. But you say in your book, nevertheless, that cancer enabled you to live in the present. And I just want to explore a bit the relationship between that uncertainty and living in the present, which is something which is bandied about as a phrase, left, right and centre, but most people don't experience very much of.
Yeah, exactly. And it's difficult to live in the present because we're worried about the future and we dwell on the past, and focusing on now, the present moment, is quite difficult to sustain. But I've made a lot of adjustments in my life and my priorities, and one of them is deprioritizing the amount of time I spent doing work and up prioritizing time with family, relationships and friendships, but particularly my family. But another is thinking about time and what I focus on. So the past is the past, and actually it's nice to reflect on the past and review my life, but that's something that I'm choosing to do in the present rather than something I'm beating myself up with. Worrying about the future, well, worrying never actually does anybody much good. It very rarely enables you to have different outcomes. So there is no point. And the power of now, just living in the moment, is very powerful. Focusing on the people around you, focusing on making connections, focusing on doing things that are joyful, and focusing on what you can do rather than being regretful about what you can't do. These are all things that are quite difficult, but can be done if you have the right intention.
Well, I think that's a kind of spur that a difficulty such as being diagnosed with cancer can give you, isn't it? Basically, the prioritisation that you spoke about, we don't quite get around to generally, do we? And so we're actually wasting our precious time, which you now realise is very precious, on all sorts of things that are not so important to us, and deprioritising things which actually really are important to us. So that, as a recipe for kind of not being here, that's a pretty good one, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think the key question that we all need to ask ourselves, those of us with a terminal cancer diagnosis, is, what is important to me in life? And that will guide, first of all, how you spend your time, and also what kind of treatment to accept from the NHS and the medical doctors and what to turn down, perhaps, because sometimes the treatment is might keep you alive for a little bit longer, but at what cost to your quality of life.
Yeah, that's a difficult judgment to call, but you're right. If you need to have your priorities in place in order to make that decision well, otherwise you'll come from a point of view of desperation and fear.
Yes, absolutely. Mm. And be influenced by family members and friends, each of whom has an opinion, and it can be overwhelming and terribly difficult. Mm. So what is quality of life for me is a very good question, and shouldn't be answered too quickly.
Right. Okay. Something else you mentioned, which again I think is connected with the issues we're talking about, is that not pretending allows you to deal with real issues. So, you know, you talk about coming round to facing up to the truth of your situation. That's a very important ingredient, isn't it? And allowing you to deal with real issues is key, in a way, to how your life is going to go at this point, isn't it?
Living, facing up to real issues. And, I mean, it sounds paradoxical. The gift of cancer, it sounds frightfully Pollyannish and priggish, doesn't it? But there are actually some real benefits to having, you know, time, ladies and gentlemen, please, called on you.
Yes.
You know, it's a wake-up call. So it forces you to think about things that most people just sleepwalk through life and never confront. So, you know, is my life how I want it to be? What's important to me that I still haven't done? Planning for your death, I think, is a big one and a good one. And, you know, planning for a good death, which takes many forms. I mean, there's lots of practical things to be done, like, you know, making sure obviously you have a will in place, but thinking about your funeral, making your wishes known so that you take the burden off your family. But also, you know, maybe making peace with people who you haven't been getting on with, maybe apologising to them or just reaching out and re-establishing contact so that you can die without regrets and, you know, feel that you've lived a good life.
Very important. Okay, you referred to one of the other quotes you have in your book from Viktor Frankl, and it chimes in with Sartre and much of what we've been talking about. When we are no longer able to change the situation, we're challenged to change ourselves. So this is kind of the opportunity that's inherent in a crisis like cancer. But in your book, you actually describe the normal stages someone has to go through before reaching acceptance that we do have a situation that we can't change. I presume you've experienced some of these yourself in the way you've just spoken about. Can you talk us through those stages?
Well, at the beginning, it's a great shock. Because, well, I certainly never expected to get cancer at all. So it's shocking. And there are practical things to think about. You know, who do you tell? How do you tell them? Your family members, your colleagues, your clients. So you go through all of that and you gradually build a bigger picture, a more realistic picture of what it is that you're facing, what kind of cancer. And you get around to dealing with that reality. It takes over your life. You know, becoming a cancer patient is like a full-time job, particularly if you choose to not just blindly accept what the NHS doles out, but research what other choices and options you have. Mm-hmm. And so more knowledge initially is completely overwhelming. As you sift through it, you might decide how to change your diet, for example. If you're able to exercise, you might not be. I mean, I've had, you know, terrible weakness and loss of fitness and completely unable to do any exercise. But I think it's very important that when you're through that you do a bit of it. I have so many different drugs and pills to take, because I don't just take the NHS stuff, I do all sorts of alternative things. So you're very busy, or I was very busy doing research and going to places and getting treatments and stuff. And sort of over time, you sort of get used to it. You know, it's a new reality. One of the important things is the effect on other family members.
Yes.
I think it's harder in many ways for the partners of the cancer patient, because as a cancer patient, you're the star of your own show. And I remember in particular when I was put on steroids before I had chemotherapy, I'd been feeling really rubbish, and then I suddenly felt exceptionally well on all these steroids, and I was, you know, not sleeping, bouncing off the ceiling, having incredible energy, really cogent, brilliant thoughts, I thought. With hindsight, I was completely manic, but I really enjoyed it. So there's that phase, and then chemo, and then that was so awful, and I was in hospital a couple of times with neutropenic sepsis, and I had fatigue, and I couldn't taste, and I had mouth ulcers, and it was all terrible. So your, you know, reality goes up and down. Over time, you sort of just get used to it. But in all of this, with all the medical tests and things and the treatment, I am the star of my own show, and people want to know how I am, and I get all the sympathy and inquiries, and poor old my long-suffering husband Jonathan, who has been utterly brilliant through this whole thing, has to be there to pick up the pieces, do all the things that I can't do, step in and do housework and, you know, shopping and taking care of finances and legal stuff that I would have done. He's got all that burden on him, and none of the, well, very little of the sympathy, and he has to think about life in the future when I'm not going to be around, whereas, you know, that's not going to be my concern.
No.
And then there's the family dynamics. I have two daughters, and one of them lives at home with us, and the other one doesn't, but how they have taken my diagnosis and their own expectations about the future and how they want to live the time that we have together and so on. And the stress and the worry, your personality kind of changes. And as I became more snappy and tetchy when I was having horrid side effects, you know, that has an effect on family dynamics. There is all of that to go through, and then reacting with the wider world, your professional life, your wider circle of friends and colleagues and so on. So there are lots and lots of adjustments to make.
All right, thank you for that. So I want to sort of branch out now. You've had quite your share of interaction with the NHS, and you've got quite a bit to say about it, I think. So you're clearly a big supporter, but I think you also want Britain to get real about its shortcomings, particularly in cancer care. Can you tell us why exactly?
Yeah, okay. So, we like to think in the UK that the NHS is wonderful. It's a sort of national treasure, best healthcare system in the world. You know, we're very proud of it.
Yeah.
And politicians, therefore, mess with it at their peril, because yes, almost anything they do, they'll be accused of privatising the NHS by stealth and making it worse and so on. Well, actually, it is not the best healthcare system in the world. Just about every advanced economy in the world has a universal healthcare system, apart from the United States. So there are at least 30 really good universal healthcare systems in advanced economies.
Right.
And rather than performing at the top of the league tables for how well we deal with patients in general, and cancer patients in particular, and specifically late stage cancer patients, we are at the bottom of the league tables. So, you know, typically out of maybe 27, 28 EU countries, we'll be performing somewhere around 23, 24, rather than top 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, which is shocking. Or yeah, fifth or sixth largest economy in the world.
I know, absolutely shocking. Anyway, I think this is where one of the things we were talking about earlier comes in. Not pretending allows you to deal with real issues. We could do with a bit of that in the NHS, couldn't we?
Yeah. Well, totally. I mean, you know, some of the NHS treatments, the NHS treatments are wonderful as far as they go. So in the short term, they can be life-saving. Mm-hmm. You then get put onto very expensive drugs developed by big pharma companies. Cost a fortune. They have to be approved by NICE. And it's limited. Nobody expects them to last forever if you have terminal cancer. Our five-year survival rates are low, as I've said, compared to other countries. Yeah. So while some of it is miraculous, it's not good enough, and it's not as good as other countries can do, so we could be doing better. And, you know, there are many complex reasons why we don't do better. Some of it's to do with money, because we allocate a smaller proportion of our GDP to healthcare in this country. And then, as you know, a smaller proportion of that goes to cancer care than in other countries. So we're dealing with limited resources. So we don't have access to all the drugs that we would be able to get in another country. Mm-hmm. But in particular, the NHS is very narrow in its view of what it accepts as being acceptable treatment. So its own protocols, obviously, but anything else outside of its protocols, which might be life extending, you don't really get a lot of encouragement from your oncologists. Mm-hmm. About them. So I'm talking about things like cannabis oil with the active ingredient THC, which is a thing that is illegal in this country, so difficult to access, although there is lots of evidence that it is destroys cancer cells. It's not evidence that medical practitioners will accept, because their currency is randomized control testing, mm-hmm. Which the pharma drug companies can do, and other alternative treatments cannot do. So how could you ever do randomized control testing on cannabis oil when it's illegal? So typically, you will be sort of looked at sideways or actively put off by the medics, which is not helpful. Mm. I guess it varies from oncologist to oncologist, and I've experienced variation in this, but on the whole, medical doctors in the NHS receive no training on diet, complementary alternative treatments, and they tend to poo-poo them and warn patients off. So instead of taking a both-and approach to both the NHS protocols and whatever complementary and alternative treatments might be helpful, of which there are many. I've mentioned cannabis with THC. There's also cannabidiol, CBD, which is completely legal, curcumin, repurposed drugs such as metformin, aspirin. There are a myriad of ancillary things that people can do if they only knew about them, but there's no signposting to, you know, what's good, what's not good, what's good for this cancer, what what level of supplements do you need to take before they're going to be effective? There is no authority that, there's no which guide to complementary and alternative treatments. There's no Ofsted for it. No. So cancer patients have to do their own research, and often in the face of opposition from the medical experts who will say, well, there's no evidence for that, and, oh, well, so-and-so is in jail in Mexico for suggesting that this might actually cure cancer. Mm. It's damaging.
Mm.
And what's disappointing is that the medical profession seem to have no curiosity. Absolutely shocked at how... They're barely interested in side effects of their own treatments,
right,
let alone the evidence of complementary and alternative treatments that are available. You'd think that they would be spending all their time in continuous professional development and looking at things like diet and repurposed drugs, but no, they don't.
No, they don't. I'm afraid, I would describe it as active disinterest, and... The reason for this, I think, is fairly easy to understand, in as much as that it's a very black and white situation in orthodox medicine, where, you know, you're either in it or you're not in it. And if you, for anyone who, for instance, found out that something or another worked that wasn't an approved medicine, if they were to even start discussing such a thing with their colleagues, they could very quickly find themselves under scrutiny for, you know, malpractice in some way. You know, literally their job is on the line, and they have their job and the power they have and all the rest of it, provided they toe the line. That's the deal, basically. And so it's extremely difficult for any of them to step out of line and take an interest in something which is working right under their nose.
So I can accept that they are fearful, yes, and have to be careful. However, I wish they would just get the hell out of the way and say, I don't know about this, but why don't you, do your own research, at least be neutral. But they are not neutral. They are often actively negative.
Yeah, I agree.
Which is so unhelpful.
Yes, well, that I agree. That is the part that's coming from the medics themselves. And as you've also pointed out, there's the commercial side of it is that medicine largely is to make money, and so there's no interest in business, obviously, in investigating anything that hasn't got massive profits attached to it. So it has to be a patentable, new-to-nature substance for that. So, these two things together.
And we don't realise that because the NHS for us is free at the point of delivery.
Yeah.
We don't realise the economic drivers of it, that the big pharma companies who do fantastic work. I mean, I completely understand why their drugs are so expensive. It's all groundbreaking. And, you know, eventually there will be cures. There's, you know, immunotherapy coming along, probably too late for me. But, the future looks bright and is extraordinarily expensive. So all of that is fine. But there needs to be also people who look at repurposed drugs, such as metformin and a few other drugs that have been shown to be effective, not necessarily curing cancer, but slowing it down, making life more difficult for the cancer cells to metastasize, so buying extra precious time. Even just aspirin. I mean, I take an aspirin every day.
Mm.
Now, if the NHS could, you know, potentially save a lot of money by using these generic off-patent drugs, but nobody does the research to validify them or to provide evidence that medics can accept. So that, I mean, there should be another body, whether it's universities, I mean, charities do a certain amount, but it's very piecemeal, it's too small. I mean, there should be a global database sharing on repurposed drugs. I mean, it all needs to be brought together in a more systematic, coherent way. And it just doesn't happen. The outside of the medical world is very piecemeal. There's nobody's driving the bus of complementary and alternative medicine. I mean, Yes to Life do a great job, but you're not having any traction. You're not changing the NHS.
No, I hope
people do good. I mean, College of Medicine, I mean, there are lots of bodies and charities that are doing bits, but they're just bits and pieces. There needs to be an overview.
I completely agree. And I think, you know, the kind of way you described is the way it's going to go is eventually that different kinds of evidence are going to hold sway, is that basically... because of complete dissatisfaction amongst patients with the way that healthcare is driven by profit, there'll be a coming together of patients to share their data, and it won't be the kind of quality of data that they seek to get within the medical world, but the volume of it will be something you can't question. And that, you know, this will actually be a driver for change in the future. It's happening in other walks of life, and it's beginning to happen in medicine as well now. So that's the big hope, is that, you know, we are educating the public with what we do, and the public will make the change in the end, because they're the people who the healthcare is for, and they're the people who have largely been cut out of the deal as to what medicine looks like. It's been carved up between the medics, the business, and the government, with business driving the whole thing. So once people understand that, then they'll want to get involved in changing it by having their own say.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is what I want to do next. I mean, the first book was Because You Can, which is focused on my experience as a cancer patient and what I think is helpful and not helpful in dealing with it, to give yourself the best chance of a good outcome and an enjoyable outcome and living the best life you can for as long as you can. That's fine, but in the course of my journey, I've discovered so much about the shortcomings of the NHS that I really want to bring to people's attention the facts that they don't know, that the NHS is really, well, it's not exactly not fit for purpose, but it's very poorly performing compared to other countries which should be doing better. So I would like to, I mean, if I knew that I would live for long enough and have the energy, my second book would be, it would be called something like Disorder and Disease in the NHS. Right. But the intention would be to do research with people who represent different positions, both within the NHS system and outside of it. So oncologists and clinical nurse specialists in the NHS, but also GPs, Macmillan, charities, hospices, academics, people in NICE, people in the pharma companies, and then people in the alternative and complementary space, dietitians, nutritionists, and people in other countries who have better outcomes to see what they're doing that we could learn from. So rather than taking it on as a big research project in a book, I've just begun to start blogging. So I will do one interview at a time and maybe get some guest bloggers to talk about their experience from where they are in the system and see, you know, what suggestions emerge, you know, what might be an acceptable currency of evidence that isn't randomized controlled testing. You know, what could academics come up with that would say, you know, this amount of case studies is good enough? Just anything that, you know, raises people's level of trust.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting issue you're talking about there. I've actually just written a blog post of my own on this subject about evidence-based medicine, and the fact that, from my standpoint, it's in direct opposition to one of the central planks of the NHS, which is patient choice. The two things that work against each other exactly.
Yes.
And hence, we don't have any choice and we've got lots of evidence-based medicine. So anyway, that's a slight side issue. You just said that you describe your own approach as a both and as opposed to an either or. So by that you mean both conventional and complementary alternative medicine. Another way of describing that, or the current way, is to describe it as integrative medicine. So what leads you to think that that's the best approach?
Yeah, integrative medicine or integrative oncology. Well, surgery, chemotherapy, radiotherapy can be life-saving and can be absolutely necessary and what's needed. But they don't save lives. Well, sometimes they save lives for early stage cancer, but for those of us with terminal cancer, they're not going to keep us alive forever. Neither are the expensive pharma company drugs, including Kadcyla, which was available and then was going to be taken off the table by NICE and now is available again, thank goodness. But, you know, there's this kind of roller coaster about which innovative drugs you can have and you can't have and what you might be able to get in other countries.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of NHS protocol. And these drugs run out because cancer's clever and it outfoxes them. So after about 18 months of Herceptin and Pertuzumab, I can expect them to fail. Then I need something else. And then when that fails, maybe a clinical trial, which may or may not work, and then I'm expected to die. So if I want to live for longer than about, you know, 2 years from diagnosis, something else has to be brought into the equation. And, you know, part of there's lots and lots of answers to that. And I will never know which will be working and which is not working.
Mm-hmm.
So I've changed my diet to be more plant-based, and I draw the line at a ketogenic diet and coffee enemas, but that's just me. Diet might help. Cannabis oil with THC might help. High dose curcumin might help. Repurposed drugs through the Care Oncology Clinic might help. All sorts of supplements might help, and I'll never know which is working and which isn't, because I haven't got time to try one and then it fails and then I try another one.
No.
Homeopathic remedies, you know, you may or may not believe in them. Rife machine, you know, the list is endless. But I am hoping that the cumulative effect of all of these different things, plus, of course, having, you know, as positive an attitude as is possible and enjoying life and reprioritizing and relaxing and so on, so not being so stressed, I'm hoping that all of those will individually make a small difference so that I get longer to live than just the NHS protocol on its own would give me.
Mm.
And so length of life and also quality of life.
Yeah. So you can be pretty sure that I think, you know, we say this with confidence to people who call us, is that if you kind of go for it in terms of looking for the very best things you can for yourself, you can't guarantee your life's going to get any longer, but you can pretty well guarantee it's going to get better during that time, just because you're not actually giving up, actually. It's much more within life itself doesn't give up, you know what I mean? It's a natural thing to actually go for it, to be forward-looking, to be optimistic, to be hopeful. And doing the very best for yourself you can actually is a good reflection of that.
Indeed. And I mean, just being active in your treatment rather than passive puts you in a much better place, a much better mental place. So, I mean, we all know that placebo is the best medicine, but the irony is you absolutely need to believe in it for it to work, and it does. And, you know, there's a lot to be said about just taking an active role in your own treatment, that, you know, each thing on its own may or may not work, but at least you are doing, you you're doing the best you can, and you can tell yourself that, and that will make you feel better. And probably then your neurotransmitters and your immune system will all kick in and make it so, even if it's not anything to do with whatever supplement it was that you were taking.
Right. Okay, well, look, I said at the outset there were far too many things to talk about, and there were. We've only got a little time left, but I want to take the opportunity to thank you for your positive mentions of Yes to Life in your book and for recommending us as a resource for people with cancer. One of the mentions is of your experience of our annual conference, in which the two main theories of cancer were compared and contrasted. And as you noted, different theories of cancer do prompt different approaches to treatment. And it seems that our event provided you with a lot of food for thought, and that subsequently supported some important treatment choices. Do you just want to say a little about that?
Yeah, so the two competing theories are that cancer is a metabolic disease, as was proposed by Otto Warburg in the 1930s, or it's a genetic disease. So if you've got the wrong genes, you're just unlucky, or your genes change. And the halfway house is that, yes, there is genetic change in the DNA, but that comes about because of the metabolic issues.
Right.
So in the UK, our medicine treats the symptoms rather than the causes. So we cut out, or we slash and we burn the cancer out, but we don't treat the root cause. So it's a bit like having a fungus growing on the side of a tree trunk that, you can lop it off, but the spores are still inside the trunk and they will come back. So what are you going to do about those? And on the whole, we don't look at the causes of cancer. You know, why is it that cancer has increased exponentially in recent years? You know, could it be anything to do with the fact that we've demonized fat and replaced it largely with sugar in our diets, which has led to immune systems being compromised and inflammation in our body and all sorts of autoimmune diseases, of which cancer is one. So I would buy into that theory and think about, what was it that led me to this place that stopped my immune system from coping with the cancer cells that all of us produce every day, and normally our immune systems can deal with perfectly. So, whether it's trauma, whether it's diet, whether it's stress, whatever you might think, people don't like to think that they're responsible for their own cancer. They'd rather think it was fate. But I think that there's a lot to be said for how we live our lives. Mm. So I've rethought all of that. And then specifically, I have joined up with the Care Oncology Clinic, where it's a private clinic in Harley Street, who offer, they're staffed by consultant oncologists from respected hospitals such as Barts, Guy's, St Mary's and so on. They are not allowed in their own NHS clinics to give this advice or prescribe these drugs, but there is sufficient evidence that metformin, doxycycline, which is a well-tolerated antibiotic that doesn't destroy your immune system quite so much, mebendazole, which is an antiparasitic drug, and atorvastatin, which is a well-tolerated statin. All of these in different ways make cancer, make conditions for cancer harder. So harder to form new blood vessels to metastasize, the environment in which their cells are existing, making them more likely to die. You know, they all work in different ways. And cumulatively, I certainly hope that those drugs will have a life-extending effect. Mm. But I'll never know which one it was,
no.
or all no. of them, or whether it was nothing to do with that, whether it was the curcumin supplements that I'm taking.
Right.
But, you know.
Most of those things have in common the fact that they're really seeing cancer as a metabolic disease and treating it accordingly.
Exactly. Mm.
Okay, yes. Well, look, we really are running out of time now, so it's been really interesting to talk to you. Thanks so much, Jill, for sharing some of your inspirational story and insights so far. Just wanted to say that Dr. Faye Gishon, one of your doctors, writes in the foreword of your book, and it's clear that you've influenced her attitude towards one that I wish all doctors had, open-mindedness about what they don't understand. You talked about this earlier.
Yes.
This single change from there's nothing that can be done to there's nothing we can do but would be the dawning of a new era in our healthcare service. So it's people like you who have the power to inspire this critical change in our oncologists. You've clearly done it with Dr. Gishon. So thank you for that and keep doing what you're doing.
Yes, she's superb, isn't she? I really loved Faye Gishon. She said in the foreword that her team has a focus on cancer survivorship, which is an unusual approach within palliative care.
Yes.
Isn't that telling? Cancer survivorship, you know, if we just had a focus on that in the whole of our health system, what a difference would that be?
It would be. All right. Thank you very much indeed, Jill.
You're very welcome, Robin. Lovely to talk to you. And yes to life. I love your conferences and all your resources and everything else. So you just need more.
Too true. Okay, goodbye.
Goodbye, Robin.
People can be so inspirational in the face of the most dire circumstances. Jill, along with many other people with late-stage cancer, is clearly demonstrating what Sartre was saying about what you do with what life throws at you. Links to the material from today's show are, as usual, on the Yes to Life website. Go to yestolife.org.uk and click the Yes to Life show logo on the homepage. Thanks for listening today. I hope you enjoyed the show. Next week's show will be the second of two shows about cannabis. Last week focused on the law and cannabis, and next week will be about the science behind it, so do make a point of listening again. Lastly, a quick plug for our book, which has just been reprinted, The Cancer Revolution. Do take a look at this great resource book by Patricia Peat and 37 other international experts at thecancerrevolution.co.uk, or of course you can buy it at booksellers everywhere. I hope you can join me again next week. Goodbye.